The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Brian Willems is assistant professor at the University of Split, Croatia, where he teaches literature at the Faculty of Philosophy and Film Theory at the Arts Academy, and his book Shooting the Moon was published in May this year from Zero Books. Lawrence A. Rickles, author of Germany, a Science Fiction, blurbed the book this way. Shooting the Moon shows how our most abiding object or objective on reality's horizon was overshot and displaced by the other reality of realization of our wish fantasies. When we ask for the moon, we travel a jump cut from an idealized past to a future of wish fulfillment lying deep inside the film medium and its ongoing history.
This is Negative Land, reminding you to get ready for the Love Canal at Love Course 49.
It's Wednesday, July 29th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear a clip from Futurama, Slavoj Žižek explaining a bottle of tea, Chris Istow-White singing the jazz standard It's Only a Paper Moon, the Evolution Control Committee's The Fucking Moon, a clip from the oral graphic entertainment Dreamies by Bill Holt, Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner performing The First Men in the Moon, Doctor Who and the Monolith reversing the polarity of the neutron flow, and Crosley Bendix's art review. The music you're listening to right now is from Negative Land, and I want to take a moment to pay respect to John Joyce, who was also known as Crosley Bendix. Joyce was a member of Negative Land, and he passed away at the age of 71 on July 22nd. So this week, before the interview, we hear a clip from one of his arts reviews.
And now, Crosley Bendix, cultural reviewer and director of Stylistic Premonitions for the Universal Media Network, with today's arts review.
Hello. I once had a film appreciation instructor who dressed entirely in corduroy and told his students that all films should be considered dreams and should be taken no more or less seriously than dreams with regard to their effect on our waking life. Now, perhaps I was just an impressionable youngster, but I believed him. That rang a buzzer, and ever since, I have gone to the movies and gone to sleep. When assigned to review a movie, I never take notes. If I can't remember it, when the lights go on and I wake up, forget it. Oh, sure, some deadlines pass and I haven't come up with anything memorable to write about. Irresponsible? No more irresponsible than some movies I've seen. Anyway, I can't be fired. I'm the boss here in the Stylistic Premonitions Department. And what's all this writing about movies worth, anyway? Publicity people create their careers by clipping that one flattering line out of context and slapping it on the big splashy ads in the weekend papers. When you think about it, all commentary on film ends up being advertising for the commercial product that movies are. Actually, when you realize all the money required to produce movies, all the skeptical investors that need to be collared, the equipment to be leased, locations to be secured, insurance processing, all the collaborative aesthetic decisions that must be made all along the way, all the uncontrollable complications and compromises that must be dealt with. It's truly amazing that this art form is even referred to as an art form. But ultimately, that's not the half of it. No, movies are far more than just some newfangled technologically based theater craft. Of course, it's difficult for us to see the forest for the fires. For instance, future archaeologists will one day be carefully digging beneath the sand that covers Los Angeles. Those future archaeologists will surely be after more than crumbling freeways. They will also be after all those ancient movies and the equipment to run them. Film directors and script writers, you're way ahead of me. That's right, this is an idea you could use. Especially appealing to those among you who like to use the old movies within movies gambit. You see, well, you can see, can't you? Deep future. Most sought after artifacts from ancient America are movies. Hollywood tar pits. Contrast between our sci-fi views of the future and how it really is. Throw in a few subplots, a love angle. You see the drift. Well, I know many directors do listen to my arts reviews, so there's a free inspiration. Take it away. A simple credit at the end would be plenty, so go ahead, it's yours. I'll sleep through it. Anyway, all that is only analogous to the point I'm actually making, which is that while movies are our most popular medium of entertainment, that won't prevent them from being recognized in the future as the highest and most significant art form of the 20th century. Integrating sight and sound in a 24 frame per second dreamlike state of receptivity, movies make their impression in time with no nagging physical residue. But unlike other theatrical arts which occur in real time, movies occur in unreal time. And as you might be able to guess, unreal time is already hitting everyone's spot art-wise and will become only more emotionally relevant as time goes on. Recent discoveries in quantum physics make this inevitable, regardless of the uncertainty principle. And finally, how could I end an arts review of movies without giving you my candidate for the greatest film of all time? Well, this is how. By substituting a brief discussion concerning why it is impossible to call yourself an American and go on promoting stupid hierarchies of evaluation proclaiming this or that number one, the quote, best. When you consider that these constant popularity contests limit our general perception of the crucial plurality of impressions, styles, values, feelings, and types of sense, which make a culture flexible and provide the only avenues for evolution and progression, you begin to see how our obsessive search for number one creates the tunnel vision down at the end of which we will eventually spot social history's locomotive of decline, bearing down on us much too fast.
Brian Willems is assistant professor at the University of Split, Croatia. He teaches literature and film theory at the Arts Academy. He is the author of Hopkins and Heidegger and Facticity, Poverty, and Clones. He's also curated exhibitions of new media artists in Croatia and Slovenia. Shooting the Moon is his first book for Zero Books. Brian Willems, welcome to the Zero Squared podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Your book is called Shooting the Moon, And it's about film. We're not shooting the moon with missiles, but taking pictures of it. How did you come to decide to write about film theory and lunar surfaces at the same time? What brought you to the moon?
that's a good question. I don't know, the film that really started it all was sort of Duncan Jones' Moon. And when I tell people about this project of sort of shooting the moon, that tends to be the first film that they ask if I've written about, and so on. So for some reason, the kind of more philosophical nature of that film, like older films like, you know, Silent Running or something like this, quite struck me quite strongly. And in part, writing the book was sort of to see if it made sense to develop a kind of a history or genealogy of moon films in which Duncan Jones sort of fits. So I use his book as the conclusion to the book. He actually tweeted about the book when it came out, so that was sort of a nice nice closure. Yeah, so that was really great. But it was basically trying to understand his film, and the, you know, the moon is a large character in that film, and so on, and just trying to figure that out. So that was his film was really the impetus of that, and then going through and making lists of, you know, what films are about the moon and seeing what sort of things they have in common and they don't, and that was the basic start.
Okay, so what movies do you cover in your book? What's the list of films?
There's five parts to the book. So the first part is called early films, and so I start with Millier's Trip to the Moon. Then I look at Fritz Lang's Woman on the Moon. I look at a Russian film called The Cosmic Voyage. Then in the second part is called Camp, and there I look at also three films: this Radar Men from the Moon, and Catwoman from the Moon, and this great Doris Wishman film, Nude on the Moon. Then in the third part, I start to look at films that are made kind of getting close to the actual Apollo 11 moon landing, when it seems like maybe an actual trip to the moon is sort of possible. So I look at this Destination Moon and Robert Altman's Countdown, and then 2001. Mm-hmm. Then I actually look at sort of footage from the moon. So look at this documentary film called Moonwalk 1 that was given access to lots of footage and so on. I look at this HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, which sort of combines actual footage and reenactments. And then I have a chapter on a film about sort of moon hoaxes. So, you know, did we really land on the moon or not? Mm-hmm. Or was it a paper moon? And I treat that film as sort of I really like with hoax films, they kind of very intensely scrutinize the images and the footage and so on. And I sort of treat this film as a kind of a textbook for close reading of images. Mm-hmm. Then in the last part, I sort of look at films. The question is, you know, after we landed on the film, what do you do with it? We found out it's kind of a boring, dusty piece of gray rock. I mean, Carl Sagan said something, you know, sort of, you know, after landing on the moon, it's, you know, well, you know, we learned that it's just, you know, there's nothing there. It's just kind of boring. So what do you do with that afterwards? So I look at this science fiction TV series, Space 1999. Mm-hmm. There's a scene from Woody Allen's Manhattan that takes place in a planetarium kind of on the moon. I look at this horror movie, Apollo 18, and then sort of some more contemporary films like Transformers 3 and Iron Sky and so on. Then I kind of conclude with Duncan Jones.
So you cover a lot of celluloid ground there, it sounds like. So in a way, your book is all about the moon as a hoax. Not that we didn't go to the moon, but that the way we've represented the moon to ourselves has always been fantastical. There's a slug line that the moon is still on some level made of green cheese in our minds, you know, and certainly in on film and in narrative films in Hollywood, the moon is still a site of fantasy.
Tranquility, we copy that. We cannot believe you are on the fucking moon. Repeat, cannot fucking believe it. Over. You're cleared to hook up lunar equipment conveyor to walk, fucking walk on the moon. Over. Holy living fuck. Are you fucking believing this? Over. We read you. Over. I abso-fucking-lutely am standing on the surface of the fucking moon. Am talking to you from the surface of the fucking moon. Jesus H. Christ in a chicken basket. Holy shit, Tranquility. Holy mother of fuck. The fucking moon. Over.
This Thomas Dish, science fiction writer, wrote about the moon that, you know, in the early days, time of 17th century of Galileo with the telescopes and so on, that the moon was sort of a piece of fantasy. And then when we got closer to the beginning of the 20th century, became an object of science fiction. And now after the landing, it's become a piece of fantasy again in that sense. But I try to, I mean, for me, the camp films that I look at don't have any less to say than the actual footage on the moon, and in fact sometimes they say more. So one of the main ideas of the book is somehow the way that films about the moon, the way that they actually miss the moon, in the sense that they either misrepresent it or it's sort of obviously fake or not the moon or a set or something like this, that the way that some of these films actually miss the moon can tell us things about the moon itself. So, you know, why does this look fakey? Why does this look strange? Why does this look unrealistic? Are kind of ways to begin to represent some actual things about the moon in that sense, just by showing us sort of what the moon isn't, perhaps, in that way.
Do you think that the moon, as it's presented in film, is, and maybe just in human history, it's kind of a stand-in mm-hmm. for what lays beyond human understanding?
The moon is, in one sense, it's something that we do understand. It's familiar. We can see physical features of the moon with the naked eye from Earth and so on. And it's in, you know, it's generally we can see it, you know, in the night sky and the day sky sometimes also. So it's a kind of a common, familiar feature from childhood of our daily lives and so on. But on the other hand, it's also a figure of absolute strangeness. So, I mean, it is another celestial body. We're sort of constantly aware of that. And at the same time, you know, with the dark side of the moon is, you know, something that was never seen, at least until the 1950s, when the Soviets had these kind of Luna flybys. The first pictures of the dark side were sent back to Earth. So in this sense, you know, the moon is kind of a liminal object, in that it's a part of both worlds. It's a part of the sensual world that we can see and understand in a fairly straightforward sense, but it's also this kind of strange figure of kind of otherness in that sense. In that half of it, for most of the time we've spent with the moon, had never been seen. So very often in moon films, that dark side is you know, where all the strange things happen, or people go underground or something like this, avoid the kind of light side that we're familiar with, and escape to this kind of this other more fantastical side of the moon, which I think then fits into this idea, you know, what you're saying, this kind of idea of the nominal realm of you know, things that lie beyond human experience or human senses.
Film is itself a medium of the industrial age and scientific and revolution, and the moon has been around for much longer than film has. These are stupid things to say, but but okay, before the Copernican Revolution, the moon was in the sky,
right?
And I realize that I don't know how people thought about the moon before the Copernican Revolution. Do you have any sense?
Yeah, I mean, you can. Yeah, you can sort of approach it in different ways. So you can approach it on most of the texts that have been written about it take one or two approaches. So one is either to approach it through science fiction or early quasi-science fiction literature. So you look at these early texts of kind of, you know, I don't know what, of trips to the moon and so on. And usually they have different functions. So it tends to be a place of where no rules apply or something like this, or a place of criticism of, you know, things going on Earth and so on. And another way to approach it then is through trying to come to a scientific understanding of what goes on there and so on. So you can have histories of, you know, drawings of the moon and so on, trying to interpret what these features are. So, you know, certain physical features that we see now seem to be quite obviously, you know, impact craters or something like this, and tracing the history of what these things, you know, were thought to have been. With the book, what I'm trying to argue is that the closer we get to the moon, the kind of more fantastical, the more fantastic the moon becomes. In a sense, the moon is more realistic the farther away we are from it, because we have more of an experience with that moon. Like Nude on the Moon, the Doris Wishman film, the opening trailer, or the opening credits of the film, it has kind of a somewhat realistic model of the moon and the craters and so on. But once the kind of two astronauts land on the moon, it looks like it was filmed in southern Florida. So it has kind of, it's palm trees and lakes and stuff like this and so on. It's something completely different. And even, I mean, a lot of these filmmakers, they knew that what they were showing on the moon was not what was there, and that Fritz Lang and so on, they knew that these things were not, they didn't think they were representing anything anything particularly realistic in that sense. They were using it.
In these films, like Fritz Lang's film, have we not fully left the geocentric model of the universe behind? Is there some clinging to a pre-Copernican notion of the universe in these films?
That's a good question. One thing I didn't expect while watching these films was, like, the, you know, when people land on the moon, you know, what's the first thing they do when they land on the moon? Right, they look at Earth. Right, I mean, that's the first shot. You know, is seeing the Earth from the moon.
Next month, when the United States of America fires the largest booster in the history of the world into space for the first time, giving us the lead, fires the largest payload into space, giving us the lead, it will be the largest payroll too.
This is a great, great honor for us, Your Majesty. We come from Earth, with good wishes from our civilization.
And to that point, how did you come?
Oh, well, just a little novelty of mine that seems to have worked. You see, I was experimenting with the photochemical reactions, and I managed to develop a means of controlling gravity, and it's quite wonderful. It will be a great benefit to humanity.
All kinds of proofs right around you that show the nearest one. A very simple one to think of is that we use plumb bobs to build buildings. In other words, to get the wall of a building going straight down, you'll take a string with a heavy weight hanging from it, and you make the building follow that string. That plumb bob will point the center of a round earth. That means that if you imagine that this was the correct earth, you can imagine a plumb bob out here point in that direction.
Robinson takes on the European middleweight champion, Gene Stock. Robinson wastes no time and goes to work.
I tend to give 2001 kind of a hard rap in the book. But one of the strangest things about that film in the second part of that film, it takes place on the moon. And I think almost every outdoor shot, let's say 25 shots during this sequence, almost every one has the Earth somewhere in the background. It's like you're not on the moon if you're not looking at the Earth. And this was one of the strangest things about Duncan Jones' movie, which was that the film takes place on the dark side of the moon, and only towards the end do these characters kind of break out of their confines and go to this other side of the moon, and they see the Earth for the first time. And it's a great shot, because in all the other films, the Earth is home and it's seen as a sort of comforting place, and oh, we're not so far and blah blah blah. But in Duncan Jones' film, the Earth is absolutely a place of terror, and they've just sent some people to come and sort of kill the people on the moon and so on. It's just this horrific place of otherness. And I think that scene is somewhat critical of the way that, you know, some of these other films, it's hard to get away from Earth even when they're on the moon.
In that movie, the Earth becomes what the moon has been in all the other films, that the Earth becomes this strange, otherworldly, unknowable place. By putting the unknown on Earth, it's humanity's own history that becomes sort of unknown to the characters.
You know, I think that's what Duncan Jones' film does, and I think, I can't remember exactly the last line of the book, but it's something like, you know, that the Earth has now become the moon for the moon, or something like this, you know, which I think is close to what you're saying. A lot of the good things that happen in these films is that what going to the moon simply does is to show how strange the Earth already is. So some of the things that, you know, kind of everyday events on Earth that we sort of take for granted, we end up seeing how strange they actually are when we're on the moon. So, for example, in Fritz Lang's Woman in the Moon, there's a scene when the astronauts leave Earth and they go to the moon, and they're in the rocket ship on their way to the moon, and they kind of look back to the Earth and they see the sunrise on Earth in that sense. And it's sort of a strange shot, because usually when we see the sunrise from the Earth, you know, the Earth feels like it's in stasis, like it's stable and it's the sun that's moving. But from the rocket ship, they see that actually, you know, the Earth is hurtling through space, and as is the sun, and they're sort of both in motion and in relationship to each other and so on. And it simply shows kind of how strange actually seeing the sunrise is.
What is your gripe about 2001? Do you?
That's a good question. I guess I like the movie. I mean,
hate the movie. I want to know what you think about it.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I'm trying. I think the one thing I think I get tired of reading so much about it, and you know how great it is. I guess the thing that I really don't like about the movie is it's kind of the role of the monolith in that film. Kubrick, there's a sort of famous Playboy interview that he did around the time of its release, and he was saying, you know, that he didn't want to give just one meaning to the monolith, that would ruin the film and so on. It's meant to be this kind of object of ambiguity, but in a sense that doesn't really work, because the monolith, it always has sort of a similar function in the film, this kind of, you know, it encourages evolution. It's sort of a progress stimulator or something like this in the film. There's no real sense of mystery to the monolith in that sense, except I think in one scene, and of course that's in this scene where the film moves to the moon, the second section of the film, and in this scene there's a scientist, Dr. Floyd, played by this William Sylvester, who's called to the moon because there's a anomaly, something strange. And he gets there and he finds out that the other people working on the moon, it's been sort of colonized at this point, have discovered buried in the under the moon's surface a monolith. So he goes there, he investigates, there's a scene where he and the rest of the astronauts have their picture taken in front of the monolith. And during this scene, the monolith emits this sort of high-pitched noise. And that's the one scene to me that's actually quite interesting, because this noise is actually quite inexplicable. I mean, it shouldn't be heard on the surface of the moon. There's no atmosphere. We don't see where it's produced in the monolith. It doesn't make any sense. We don't understand it in any way. And after this noise appears, this section of the film ends. We move on to another time period. So this is sort of, for me, the one moment where something happens in the film that's inexplicable, that happens outside of scientific understanding. There's no science in the film to explain it, and there's no science in the future of the film that will also explain it. So science doesn't help. Yes, the sound is just strange. And we can do something with this. We can look at something like this, like Quentin Mayasu has this idea, this book called Extro Science Fiction, where he's looking at science fiction. He looks for moments of such strangeness. He sort of says that, like, in general, science fiction kind of implies that even if weird things happen, that science will still exist and will theoretically be able to explain these weird things in some kind of future. But he's sort of interested in looking at moments where the things happen in science fiction books that are inexplicable. Science can't explain it now. There will be no science to explain it in the future. And he calls these moments kind of extra science fiction, sort of outside of science fiction. Come back to 2001, most of the movie is sort of science fiction. And there's this one moment with this sound that's this kind of extra science fiction, sort of outside of explanation in that sense. And that, to me, is the most interesting moment of the film, where the monolith actually becomes strange.
Well, I have this perverse desire to disabuse you of your sense of wonder about that moment in the film and just tell you that what happened in the monolith, what happened was that that the monolith reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
Do anything, Doctor!
Not unless we change the polarity.
Reverse it.
Reverse what?
Reverse the polarity.
I reverse the polarity of the neutron flow.
Reverse the polarity.
What?
Reverse the temporal polarity.
What are you doing?
I'm reversing the polarity of my ultrasonic screwdriver's power source.
Reverse the polarity.
He's reversed the polarity!
I just reversed the polarity.
Reverse the polarity of the neutron flow.
Reverse its polarity.
If I reverse the polarity of the neutron flow.
I've reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
Reverse the polarity.
Reverse the polarity of the neutron flow.
Of course, if you think about it, those words together don't mean anything. Okay, there's two things I want to ask you about, and let's see if I can articulate them. One is that it seems to me that your book is really quite a bit about gazes or subjectivity. Maybe those two things together. That what you're always looking at in your film, in your book, is how films treat the human subject and what the moon means for human subjectivity. At least that's, do you think that's a fair
assessment? I like that. Yeah, that's sort of interesting.
Yeah, so like, you know, human subjectivity itself, what it is to be a human subject is different when you're on a rocket watching the universe whiz around, you know, the sun moving and the earth moving both, rather than some sort of more staged scene of a sunrise that you're used to on Earth. That makes you a different kind of subject to be in that position, to see things from that position. And film itself is always playing with human subjectivity and trying to establish a subject. It's one of the things that film does. I'll come back to that and see if I can just add one other thing to the moon. Oh, which is that one of the results of the Copernican Revolution was that what it meant to be a human subject radically changed. And we're still, I think, dealing with the repercussions of giving up the geocentric model, even at this late date. In a movie, establishing a subject is difficult because the point of view is always actually shifting around, and there's been a development of this film grammar to try to trick the audience into thinking that there is one subject that's really watching this whole movie, even though that, if you, for the most part, that's impossible. There are things, rules that you can't break in order to maintain that illusion, like the 180 degree rule and things like that. But that's one of the problems that filmmaking itself has to deal with, is maintaining the illusion of a subject, especially narrative film. Now, in science fiction films, how does the moon fit in with the larger problem of subjectivity that's in film? And this is one of the questions I asked you. How does the moon appear in relationship to the concept of suture? And a suture is this device that's used to kind of fix up problems in films where the subject is in question and you don't know who's watching. I've asked my very long, complicated...
No, that's a great question. And it, when you posed it before, it made me think about some of the things in the book in a different way. And I really appreciate this sort of, you know, this the thought behind it and so on. The construction, you know, of a subject in that sense. I mean, it happens in film. Of course, it happens in literature too, right? So, I mean, you can, you know, this idea of creating a sort of narratee or addressee or something like this, that's, you know, obviously, different from the person who's actually reading your work in that sense. And sometimes this can be done in sort of a, you know, quite conscious manner in some way. So you think about something like in literature, like this book, Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. The addressee of that book is a cloned human being whose organs are meant to be harvested for non-clones in that sense. Presumably, the person who is reading that book is not actually a clone in that sense. So, in some way, the difference between the narratee of the book and the actual reader in that sense becomes, you know, part of the story in some way. And then, of course, I mean, you know, that is done in somewhat of a conscious sense, but of course, you know, the unconscious ideologies of filmmakers can do that too. You know, people like Laura Mulvey and Bell Hooks and so on have, you know, done a lot to expose that. So, you know, you think of the classic scene of a woman stepping out of a car and it's, you know, filmed from her leg up and so on, you know, these sort of creating this idea of the heterosexual male viewer who's supposed to be enjoying this image either on his own or through the gaze of another heterosexual male on screen and so on. And there are sort of different ways that, you know, that film works to sort of, as you were saying, you know, kind of tie in a sense, you know, viewers to the narrative through these sorts of points of view and so on, which of course are, you know, slippery, thankfully, and never quite solidify and so on. But the way that I think it relates to the moon in some sense is in some ways representations of the moon in the book are slippery in that I tend to like movies or enjoy looking at movies where the moon has more than one kind of representation in a film. So if you look at something like even like, you know, like Millet's Trip to the Moon, that the beginning of the film, the moon, the first time the moon is represented, it's on a chalkboard. It's kind of a fuzzy circle that's meant to be filled in with knowledge, and then it's seen from the ground in the sky is also this kind of strange, you know, disc and without any features. Then there's the famous shot of the moon man sort of landing in the eye, and then there's a second landing on the surface of the moon, where it becomes this kind of fantastic place with giant mushrooms and so on. And what I would like about these types of films is that one type of representation of the moon does not negate another type. So you can even have the landing shown twice in two different ways, one fantastical, one maybe less. But all these sort of different representations are kind of culled together and are maybe in tension with each other in some sense. And I think that this kind of multiplicity of representations also then informs the way that that subjectivity is constructed in the film. There's not, I think that there are films where there's more than one type of subjectivity created in the film, or rather different types of subjectivities which are created in the film come into tension with each other in that sense and start to become an issue. So if you go back to that example of, you know, Fritz Lang's film or something like this, as you were mentioning, you know, you have the subjectivity of seeing the sunrise from Earth, the subjectivity of seeing it from a rocket ship. You have the subjectivity of, you know, seeing the Earth from the Moon from different ways, and so on. And I think that these films, because you're on an object which is not on the Earth but is close enough to the Earth in that sense to be able to make some kind of comparisons to subjectivities created on and off the planet, I think that they lend themselves to foregrounding the way in which sort of various points of view, in that sense, when shown together, start to bring out this kind of tension between them.
In the book Cartographies of the Absolute, that book starts by describing a film. I think it's called By the Power of Ten. It's just a shot of a couple on Earth having a picnic at the beginning, and the camera is like 10 feet above them, and then it moves up, you know, by a factor of 10. Each shot, and eventually you've got to this point where you're looking at, you know, the whole universe, and then I think you end up looking at darkness. I mean, you get so far out that all perspective is lost, and so there's multiple subjectivities in this film. With every cut, you've got a new perspective, but at the same time, the whole process is itself a kind of perspective. It requires a scientific perspective. There is somewhere. I mean, it's very disconcerting. It would be to watch, and maybe it's true that by the end you don't know where you're standing, and you have lost perspective. But it seems that even losing perspective, even losing a sense of a solid location, itself requires a solid location from which you can view this happening where you've lost your so seems like to me that the same thing happens in a science fiction movie where you're going from the Earth to the Moon and you see these are and in between you're seeing both spots at the same time, that there is a subjectivity at work or a embodied location that can take in all of these different perspectives, an overall one, just to say, in the same way that the film audience, you know, is that locations, the locus for the whole narrative, even as it shifts around.
Yeah, no, that film that you mentioned at the beginning, this Powers of Ten, is a great example. So that's this. It's made by IBM, I think, in 1977 or something. Some employees for IBM, sort of made it. And it starts on this, you know, in Chicago or something, people on the grass having the picnic, and zooms out. I can't remember to what, but yes, basically to, you know, to a million, what, I don't really know what the scale is. And then it reverses, and it goes back at the second part of the film. It goes back to the people having a picnic, and it goes down into the man's arm or something, and goes into like sub quantum levels and so on. And that film, whenever I see it gives me a real, I mean, I feel like throwing up. It really gives me that sense of vertigo. And even the reason for it is, you know, is because of what you're saying, I think, because, you know, I'm seeing it from a certain subjectivity, right, from a certain human scale that is normal to me in that sense. And it becomes, you know, when I relate it to that scale, it becomes powerful because it's unusual and disconcerting. But it wouldn't be disconcerting if you weren't seeing it from any perspective whatsoever. And that's, if you have a world in which there are no rules, absolutely no rules, where everything is actually random in that way, where every point of view is possible, you cannot do anything. I mean, there's nothing to talk about. Somehow what becomes powerful, you know, to us is to have worlds that we at least understand the functioning of in some ways, and to have events that then unsettle us from those positions. So there are different ways to do it in film. So Stephen Shaviro or Laura Marx both talk about this quite a bit in the sense that film can dislocate you. You don't know what you are looking at, from what perspective, and so on. Stephen Shaviro connects this to a sense of masochism, that you are opening yourself up to the choices of others. Is it going to turn into something horrible or pleasurable or something? He uses the beginning of Catherine Bigelow's Blue Steel, where a gun is shown up at the beginning, is shown in such close up that you don't know exactly what you're looking at until eventually you kind of put the pieces together and you figure out it's this weapon and so on, which is what the film tries to do, kind of deconstruct the idea of what a gun means in film, which is sort of a very loaded topic. Sorry about that. So film can often do that. It's, you know, it dislodges you from knowing exactly where you are, what you're looking at, what you're reading about. But as far as trying to have a book where, or a film where, you know, there's no subjectivity, I don't know. You know, think of something like Olaf Stapleton's, you know, like Star Maker or something like this from 1930s. I mean, that's a book where it's trying to have such a huge, absolutely huge scale and huge section of worlds and types of thought and things that eventually you get a feeling of not knowing kind of where you stand in some sense in that way. And he does a lot of work to try and get rid of this kind of I anywhere and what is trying to have this kind of collective consciousnesses tied by telepathy and stuff like this. But I don't know. I think in general, if there's no rules, then you can't talk. So it doesn't, you know, if that exists, we have nothing to say about it.
Right. Yeah. I recently watched a short bit of Zizek, who's one of my heroes, talking about this issue, about how continental philosophy is historicist because it is always asserting what I think you've been kind of asserting. Both directly and then sort of as an unconscious tick throughout this interview, which is that you tend to say in that sense, because you want to point out that there are other senses and that we don't want to make an assertion that is that's universal in all senses, but just always in this sense and that sense. And this is this historicist urge, which on the one hand is completely justified, and is what we've both been agreeing about, which is to say, you know, any perspective, even the perspective of chaos, even the perspective of dissolution, always already has an historical moment in which it is taking place. The subjectivity is always already there, even if it's dissolving, and so you're always talking about a particular moment, a particular person, a particular worldview that's in play. On the other hand, what Zizek wants to say is that this fact is itself, and I think this is what he wants to say. And frankly, sometimes I get lost with Zizek; he's so eclectic.
He copies and pastes enough that you eventually
pick up. Right. Yeah, he rewrote, you know, the same book a dozen times. But what I think he's getting at in every single book is that this which is a Hegelian notion, which is that this fact of the necessity of a perspective is itself universal. It doesn't require any particular sense for it to be the case.
Who believes what today? Oh, I think this is an interesting question, much more complex than it may appear. The first myth to be abandoned, I think, is the idea that we live in a cynical era where nobody believes, no values, and so on, and that there were sometimes more traditional where people still believed, relied on some substantial notion of belief and so on and so on. I think it's today that we believe more than ever. And as Fowler develops it in a nice ironic way, the ultimate form of belief for him is deconstructionism. Why? Again, I'm going back to that question of quote marks, no? Like, look how it functions, deconstructionism, in its standard version already at the texture of style. Like, you cannot find one text of Derrida without A, all of the quotation marks, and B, all of these rhetorical distanciations. Somebody like Judith Butler were to be asked, what is this? She would never have said, this is a bottle of tea. She would have said something like, if we accept the metaphysical notion of language identifying clearly objects, may we not, she likes to put it in this rhetorical way, risk the hypothesis that in the conditions of our language game, this can be said to be a bottle of tea and so on and so on. So it's always this need to distanciate. Why this fear? Because I claim that when the ancients directly said, I love you, they meant exactly the same. So it's we today who are afraid that if we were to put it directly, I love you, that it would mean too much. We believe in it.
Say it's only a paper moon. hanging over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played in a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
It's almost as if we disavow what we are asserting when we ignore the fact of that universality, of the necessity of embodiment as a universal itself.
I mean, this is an idea that the book at times addresses and maybe skirts around. In one of the ways, perhaps, that it starts to be addressed is in the camp film Radar Men from the Moon. sorry.
Yeah, that's great.
But there's a scene in that in it's the film. It's a serial from the 1950s. Basically, there's some moon men have developed atomic weapons, and they want to attack Earth. And there's one Commander Cody, a guy who flies back and forth from the Earth to the Moon to sort of save the Earth. But there's a scene where Commander Cody has stolen an atomic weapon and is running away with it, and the Moon Men are chasing him, and Commander Cody runs into a cave, and then the Moon Men shoot a kind of heat ray at the cave, and they melt the cave in that sense. And there's these sort of great special effects scenes made by the Lidecker brothers. It was actually taken from another earlier movie serial called The King of the Rocket Men, but called from that and put into this film. But it's this sort of melting rock in this sense, and the movie's given over a little bit to just the pleasure of this effect of seeing sort of a screen. Half the screen is rock in its solid state, and the other half is it's sort of turning into this kind of primordial ooze in this sense. And it's sort of an image that's repeated a number of times throughout the film, with sort of volcanoes exploding and so on. And I start to use that a little bit to try and talk about ideas of, like, you know, the universality of subjectivity, and if there's a way of kind of representing or understanding something that, you know, lies outside of that. So I start to talk about Maya Su's idea of ancestrality. So, you know, that there was what lies outside of human thought. Well, when there were no humans, there was no human thought in that sense. So the Earth, which existed before humans existed on the Earth, is a figure of what existed outside of before, kind of subjectivity in that sense, although it becomes something that we can know once humans, I mean, human thought has to be in human bodies and so on, once they sort of exist. So he uses this idea of, you know, of the ancestral Earth as this kind of pre figure of subjectivity and so on. And I start to use people in another Zero book title, this Ben Woodard, this slime dynamics. Here he talks a little bit too about this idea of this kind of primordial ooze as kind of the beginnings of embodiment and subjectivity and representations of this kind of this moment. And I think that that part of this bit of theoretical work of the text is that this moon, this object, is a figure that's kind of older than us. And very often the weird in these films, the weird creatures and people that live there have been living there for, you know, 30 million years or something like this, or somehow outside of our time and experience in a sense. And there might be, I don't really have a full answer for you in that sense, but there might be sort of leanings towards trying to address something like that.
Well, this very kind of simple thought came to me, which is that if you're talking about the time on Earth before humans, you can only ever think of it, or that time could never exist before humans. That, in other words, yes, the Earth existed before humans, but when it existed then, it was not the time before humans. It was only once humans came around that retrospectively you could think of that time as the time before humans. Which, you know, again, is one of those things that may sound wiser than it actually is. So let me turn this around, give you the reins, sort of. You wanted to ask me a few questions about my short story about the moon.
Right, yeah. So looking at this sort of this last Apollo mission story of yours, and what was sort of intriguing to me and has been intriguing me throughout is sort of this connection between the moon and the unreal or the false or the fantastic. And in that story, you kind of not just play with this, but there's sort of an issue in the story. And my question for you was, what I would like to hear from you is sort of, is there a connection somehow between the moon and the fake, the fantastic in that sense, and truth somehow? I mean, is it just that, you know, the moon is a place of fantasy in that sense, but does it also lead to some kind of notion of truth that we might not be able to find otherwise, maybe?
Well, I think it does. Well, it does have a connection to truth, and in the story, the main character is brought into a conspiracy by Stanley Kubrick to recreate the moon landing, which apparently was a hoax the first time, and they're going to hoax the world a second time. And she's brought to the World Trade Center, into the basement of the World Trade Center, to work on a secret film project, a secret film of a new moon landing. And this, I don't know if this is stated directly in the story, but the idea is that the U.S. government has decided that the culture has lost its center, that we don't have a national project or a global project anymore, and that there needs to be a way of inventing one. So going to the moon again would be that project. The fact that it's fake, I think, is necessary for it to be that national project. I think that's at least, that's not stated, but in the story directly, but it is what I'm wrestling with, and I underline that point by looking at the short story the main character had written that got Kubrick's attention, which was all about this guy that's a surrealist constructive artist, Joseph Cornell, who made these little boxes, and he would take parts of the world that mattered to him and put them behind glass and kind of cut them out from the world to be emblems of ideas or of feelings that he was having, that they would be apart from the ebb and flow of the natural world and become a bit distant. You can't quite touch those. You can't touch those things anymore. And in the story within the story, the main character decides that she is sick of her brother, because the main character is the brother of Joseph Cornell, and she smashes these artworks in order to get at the truth. And once she does that, her world falls apart. The truth can't be sustained without a fiction, is the point of that. So yeah, that's everything that I'm kind of, those are the philosophical ideas, or those are the ideas that I was playing with as I wrote the story. So yes, the moon is exactly the same kind of object as one of Joseph Cornell's boxes. It's
a nice way of putting it. Yeah, there are some films, I mentioned there's this French film, this kind of Operation Luna, it's a fake documentary about Kubrick, supposedly, you know, being hired to make a fake moon landing in case the real one didn't work, so that, you know, we'd still have this kind of national myth to do it. But the film's really strange. They actually got Kubrick's wife and Buzz Aldrin and some other actual figures. Donald Rumsfeld, I think, gave real interviews for this fake documentary. They thought they were talking about kind of a real moon landing, and then they sort of re-edited what they were saying to fit into this kind of fake documentary. And there's this Russian, this first on the moon, kind of, it's not really a mockumentary. It purports to be this story of the Russians, Soviets landing on the moon in the 1930s, so before the Americans. But the film is really strange. It's very it's filmed like, in a sense, it's meant to look like it's found footage and so on, but it's very obvious that it isn't. I mean, the film is quite clearly fake, except for the end. The last two shots, the most of the film is about the recording of the training of the cosmonauts and so on. But then the last two shots of the film, or the two of the last shots of the film, one is an actual cosmonaut on a ship in orbit, and the other one is just a really, really shaky footage just for a few seconds of the moon in some sense, and everything else sort of takes place on Earth. And there's these two little moments of kind of truth in all the sort of fakiness of the film in a sense. So somehow, to me, these films are also interesting in this sense. Okay, this idea of, you know, that, you know, you need fiction in order to, you know, to find the truth and so on. But I think that what's interesting also with some of these films is sort of the, you know, the tension between this lack of realism and truth in that way. And I think somehow, like you said, the moon is kind of a key object maybe for that tension.
That movie that you mentioned, I thought it was really funny. I've come across it before, and I always wondered if the subjects of that movie were in on the joke, or if they some of those interviews were called from other projects. I think that they were. I think there was the same filmmaker made a serious film about Rumsfeld, maybe, and then took some outtakes from that. I'm not sure, but what do you mean when you say that the hoax or a fiction or something a little untrue is necessary for there to be truth? Or is that what you're saying?
Sort of. I mean, in a sense, you think about, you know, one of the issues maybe with science fiction is sort of all of the emancipatory technologies of utopia that were supposed to, you know, set us free in the future. In a sense, they've already been sort of taken over and corrupted and are being used against us in some way. So it's kind of harder, getting harder and harder, perhaps, to think of the future as a place of freedom or of new choice. What becomes more clear is kind of looking at the past in some way for some kind of alternative. So you can look at sort of some alternate histories and so on, which are kind of what both of these, what we're talking about here. However, if an alternative history purports to be sort of the real truth in some sense, it's still functioning under perhaps some of the same constrictions, or it's still trying to be kind of still pretending to be sort of an operative truth in some way. Mm-hmm. But if you have something, perhaps a story that's taking place in the past and is really obviously not true, maybe this sort of this kind of playing or fantasy in that way can open up perhaps some alternatives in some sense, just because of the kind of obviousness of its not being real.
Can I do the countdown?
Huh? Oh, sure. Knock yourself out.
10, 9.
Okay, we're here.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off. Hurry up, I want to see the moon.
Relax, it's open till 9.
That's one small step for Fry.
And one giant line for admission. You're not going to believe this, but they landed an amusement park on the moon.
Gah. It's the happiest place orbiting Earth.
If in 5 to 10 years, one of these entrepreneurs who are working on making space travel a thing of the future again gets it together, puts together a little business and offers flights to the moon in your neighborhood that you could leave from your neighborhood at a reasonable price, would you want to go to the moon?
Yeah, of course. I mean, absolutely. I would be scared. I mean, I don't know. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, it would be a scary experience. But yeah, of course. I mean, to me, what's becoming the interesting question now is Mars in that sense, right? So you know this idea of having to give your life to make the trip and so on. And we already kind of know what's there, and there's not that sense of perhaps surprise and so on. That to me, there's this Martian movie, coming out with this Matt Damon or whatever, based on this. Is it, what's the name of the author? Is it Andrew Weir or something? He like self-published the book and now it got picked up and made in this film. So this, somehow the moon. I mean, that would of course that would be amazing if anyone's listening in in the future and wants to give me a ticket. But somehow it seems that Mars is sort of the pressing question of travel and what it would take to do and sort of at the edge of what we would be able to start to start to think about or actually imagine, maybe.
Well, actually, I think right now, the big new horizon is Pluto, right?
Right.
We just got those pictures back. It turns out that Pluto is the Death Star. Have you seen those?
Right. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, the superimposition or the photoshopping of the Death Star onto Pluto. I'm not sure what the value is of being on the moon now. Besides of, for minerals and stuff like this.
But you don't know what the value is, but you'd still go.
I'd still go.